Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What should we do about climate change, and what will happen if we don't act aggressively enough to reverse the damage we have already done? By some estimates, hundreds of thousands of human lives are being lost every year to the warming of the planet documented by scientists, and experts predict tens of millions more will be forced to flee their home communities as the problem gets worse. My guest today is aware of the challenges that face the world as we find it in 2009, but she is committed to ensuring that we leave it in better shape for future generations. Frances Beinecke is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy, Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. Frances, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
The book really serves as a reminder that although we tend to think of this as a scientific issue or a political issue, it is in fact also a humanitarian issue. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I really feel that as we look at the full range of impacts that climate change will bring on, that the ones we should be most focused on and most aware of are the effect on people. Because the reality is that it's people all around the world, people who live in poverty, who really cannot adjust to the changes that climate change will bring, who are most at risk. And this is something, you know, that's been raised particularly by people in the Global South, including important world leaders like Kofi Annan, who started a global humanitarian forum to address the humanitarian issues directly.
Let's talk for a minute about the numbers of deaths that are already being attributed to climate change. First of all, can you talk about the kinds of criteria that are applied in order to say this is because of climate change?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things, there's a lot of cause and effect that isn't directly related now. But as the science on climate change gets much more definitive, it's clear that the range of acute storm events will increase. So, for example, sea level rise is one of the things that is very likely to happen, particularly by the end of this century. And literally, a billion people live within what it would be a meter of sea level rise around the world. So those people are vulnerable because, you know, they're poor, they don't have places to go to, many of them, and they will be, in essence, their homes will be lost. So that's a serious issue. There's also an issue which is emerging that is less known, but more and more work is being done on it, which is the spread of disease. As climates change, the disease vectors change too. So say a disease like dengue fever, which is, you know, well known in the tropics, and in the southern hemisphere is moving further north all the time. And in fact, I think actually even in Texas there have been an increasing number of identified cases. So where disease has been expected in the past, those territories may change quite a great deal going into the future. So it's not only the impact of habitat change and significant storm events, but disease as well. So, you know, the numbers get to be larger and larger, running into millions of people over time. And, you know, a lot of the organizations that work on development issues, like the International Rescue Committee, where perhaps they started because of political refugee issues, now are migrating into issues of how to address climate refugees that we'll be faced with in the future.
And in fact, climate change is now on the radar of the CIA, of all agencies. Can you talk about the kinds of conditions that the Center on Climate Change and National Security is charged with monitoring?
Yes, well, increasingly, our international security agencies, like the Pentagon, like the CIA, are doing analyses, sort of doing projections into the future and what kinds of conflict that could cause that they should be aware of and may have to address. So, you know, as climate change moves forward and crosses the globe, issues that stress people, such as drought, famine, loss of water, create conflicts in certain regions that are already stressed and very arid. As those tensions and conflicts develop, those are things that the U.S. could, because we are an international global leader, could be brought into. So what the Pentagon and the CIA, in fact, the CIA just in the fall opened a department to look at the stresses that climate change can cause. What they're really addressing is where may they be drawn in the future around burgeoning conflicts that are a direct result of climate change. And, you know, interestingly, some of our leading security voices like Admiral Gunn from the Navy and General Zinni are two individuals who are speaking out more and more about being prepared for these emerging conflicts and recognizing that they are on the horizon, and this is something the United States military has to take quite seriously and prepare for.
Frances Beinecke is my guest. She is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. What can we expect to happen in terms of the global economy as the planet continues to warm?
Well, I think that there are various scenarios out there, Chris, and they could be good and they could be bad. One of the things that I've really tried to emphasize in my book, Clean Energy Common Sense, is that there is a real opportunity for an upside if we get going and invest in it, and that is in the range of clean energy technologies that are out there. You know, already there's a great deal of interest, not only in the big multinational companies that are developing these technologies, but in entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, not just in the United States, but really all over the world. If you look at the kind of investment that's already been made in Europe, in Denmark, in Germany, in Spain, and increasingly in China, where a very significant amount of their stimulus package went into clean energy technologies, there's a real opportunity for an economic upside with a lot of people being put to work and a lot of money made off of these technologies in the future. Of course, the downside is the impacts, that if we don't get going and begin to address it, the consequences are enormous, and we can lose ground, particularly in areas like agriculture, which, you know, are the economic underpinning of a lot of countries. And if the conditions change dramatically to change agricultural output, that could be a very significant problem for a lot of countries.
Have we already got, at least in a primary sense, the technologies that we will need, and now it's a matter of making sure that they receive adequate funding and development?
Well, we have a lot of technologies available right now, and we have done a lot of analysis at NRDC, and others have done it as well, to show that if we unleashed what we have right now, we could begin to bend the curve on carbon emissions in this country and really head down a significant decline, which is what the objective is. But, you know, we also expect that American ingenuity and creativity and entrepreneurial spirit will unleash new technologies, particularly towards the middle part of the century between 2020 and 2030, that we haven't even thought of yet, which will move us even more rapidly towards a low-carbon clean energy future. So, yes, we have what we need right now to get going, but, yes, we want to unleash that American creativity to really identify new technologies, new efficiencies that can be gained to reach us toward, to get us to our mid-century objective, which is an 80% decline in carbon emissions.
Do you sense that there's still a hesitation on the part of private investors to put their capital in one technology or another, given that we don't yet have a clear picture of exactly where the greatest development will take place?
Well, I think that the uncertainty that investors have is really the uncertainty about what the policy formulation will be. And that gets back to Congress' current consideration of clean energy legislation. I've talked to a lot of people, particularly in the renewables industry, those who are in the wind business, of which there's a lot in Texas. You know, the policies and the tax advantages change year in and year out. And what is really necessary for a long-term investment is consistency and longevity in the policy design that we need to put in place, both at the state level and at the federal level. And until that happens, you know, there are a lot of financial sources, those who put the capital behind the entrepreneurs, who are holding back until they know what the rules of the game are.
How effective has the stimulus money been so far that's supposed to stimulate the green economy?
Well, I think the stimulus package has been very, very important, particularly in unleashing the opportunity in the area of efficiency. The quickest, fastest way to and cheapest way to reduce carbon emissions is to invest in energy efficiency, including, you know, the weatherization of our homes, building and having more energy efficient appliances and electronics, having smart grids so we can identify how we're using power in the home and in the region. The stimulus package has actually done a good job at getting those things much more actively into the marketplace, and I think it is a case study for how clean energy solutions can really work going forward. But it's just a down payment. We need to do a great deal more than that.
When that money runs out, when the program is complete, do you think the assumption is on the part of lawmakers that that will be it?
Well, it's a good question, Chris, because there is a lot of discussion now about, particularly with the unemployment numbers staying quite elevated, the need for additional stimulus. And so there is a lot of talk about needing kind of a second round of a stimulus package. I have no idea whether that will happen or not, but I'm confident that if it does happen, clean energy jobs will be continue to be a major component of it, because these are things that can be unleashed immediately, have a double win. They both put people to work, and they invest in a clean energy future. And the other good thing about efficiency investments is they lower the electric bills of the individual. So it helps people in the long run in their day-to-day expenses, which is also very much on the mind of the administration.
We've already talked today about the concerns in other parts of the world and the fact that the situation there is more grave. But I wonder if you'll talk for a minute about the changes that we've seen in the condition of U.S. natural resources in the past couple of decades.
Well, you know, I think let's just start with Alaska, which is our peak into the Arctic. And already across Alaska, there are significant changes along the North Slope where there's tremendous melting going forward. The permafrost is melting. Alaskan villages are literally falling into the sea to the point that they have to be relocated to a point of higher ground and greater stability. Also in the West, we've seen an increasing amount of wildfires that have sort of raged across the West. And I'm sure, you know, people are familiar with seeing that sort of later summer, early fall, where the amount of acreage that's succumbing to wildfires is increasing every year, and also the amount of acreage that is succumbing to pest infestations, where the changing climate has unleashed beetle infestations across the Rocky Mountain West and all the way up into British Columbia, where the devastation has been really acute. And those areas then are more vulnerable to fire. So those are changes we're seeing on the ground. And then it's very interesting. I mean, people who are gardeners actually have kept a running record of what those changes are in the growing season. You know, can they plant earlier? Is the harvest later? You know, when do plants begin to flower as opposed to when they used to? What are the migration patterns of birds? There's a lot of on-the-ground documentation increasingly of where the changes are. And that's very, very different, for example, from where it was a decade ago. In the 90s, when people talked about climate change, a lot of the talk was around computer modeling, what people thought might happen if conditions were X, Y, or Z. Now, you know, there's really a great deal more observation that people can use to really show what those changing patterns are. And, of course, you know, I guess one of the best-known examples is the loss of snowmelt and glaciers. You know, in a place like Glacier National Park, which is sort of an iconic feature in the United States, but those glaciers have, you know, nearly disappeared and will and are expected to disappear, you know, within the foreseeable future. So that's something that people can see for themselves. You can see the before and after photos, you know, not only in Glacier National Park, but in Alaska, you know, across Europe, et cetera.
Frances Beinecke is my guest. She's president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frances Beinecke, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Frances, what message do you think President Obama's physical presence in Copenhagen will send to the world about American recognition of the gravity of the situation?
Well, I think it's having the president go to Copenhagen sends a very strong signal that he and the United States is very serious about taking the steps necessary to reduce our carbon emissions. We have made tremendous progress over the last year under his presidency, both on the regulatory side and by getting a legislative process going. A bill is passed through the House and is under consideration in the Senate, and he's committed to getting legislative action. So I think that there is no better person to tell the world that this is an issue that the United States takes very seriously, that we intend to act, strongly, and that it will happen quite soon.
What, from your perspective, are the bare minimums you would like to see in terms of binding legislation that will ultimately come from that treaty after Copenhagen?
Well, the most important thing for the United States is to set targets and timetables, to have a goal of what our emission reductions should be and get us on that pathway. So for us, with the legislation under consideration now has a 17 to 20% target, 17 in the House, 20% in the Senate, and an 83% reduction by, that would be for 2020, an 83% reduction by 2050. There's a big difference in the developed world and the developing world. We have probably made the largest contributions to carbon in the atmosphere historically, so the world expects the United States to take a leadership position and act strongly. Europe would like us to take stronger targets than the one I mentioned, but I think that the important signal for the United States is to show that we're serious, that we're going to get going, and that we can meet those midterm targets. What will happen in Copenhagen is that we will begin the process, which will not be concluded there, but it will be a continuation of an ongoing process over the last several years to put in place what the components of an internationally binding treaty would be. And in essence, the world has waited for the U.S. to come up with a position that it could build the treaty around. And because the legislative process in the Senate and in Congress is not completed, we can't really agree on a final structure for an international treaty, which is one, not the only, but one of the reasons that the specific design has been delayed until later in the year or later in 2010.
To what extent is this still a partisan issue in the United States?
Well, it has been, but I think increasingly less so. So if you look at initiative in the states, for example, early on, Governor Pataki in New York, when he was still governor, took important steps. Governor Schwarzenegger in California has taken very important steps, to Republicans. Most recently, Senator Graham from South Carolina, leading Republican, has committed to partnering up with Senator John Kerry to develop a bipartisan approach that could be adopted in the Senate. So there is a history of partisanship, but I think that's breaking down, and I think that it's absolutely critical that we have a bipartisan approach. This is not it should not be a political football. This is an issue that deals with the well-being of all people, and it's really something that we should come together on, and I'm hopeful that we will.
We have an email here from Scott in Dallas who writes, a lot of people I know are very up in arms about the hacked climate change emails. It seems to be fueling speculation that the whole global warming issue is really about a first step in bringing about a one-world government. What do you say to the idea that global warming and climate change are not caused by man, but rather natural occurrences having to do with sun cycles?
Well, I just I absolutely don't agree with that. I think that the science on climate change is quite definitive. There have been over 2,500 scientists worldwide, climatologists, meteorologists who work on these issues professionally every day, who've come together with very definitive information under the auspices of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So I think the science is quite definitive, and it's there, if you go on the UN website, it's there for everyone to see. And I think that it's only getting stronger as more and more information comes in.
What would you counsel scientific journals when they are presented with an argument that seems to present a counterintuitive position on something? Should they be more open than they are now? I mean, can you give us some perspective?
Well, it's not clear to me, Chris, first of all, that they're not open. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that the scientific community are masters at challenging one another through their peer review process, through their publications. The great thing about science is there is always a lively debate going on within the scientific community about, what information that they do gather through data and research and other things, what it indicates, what it really tells. So, I expect the scientific analysis of all aspects of climate change, and there's so many, to continue going on well into the future, and the debate to continue to be lively, because they are fundamentally on a quest for knowledge, and I think that that's an iterative process going forward. But I still think that if you look at the body of science that has been built over the last 20 years and even longer than that, it's definitive to the point that 190 nations are coming together in Copenhagen to try to work through what an international agreement would be, needs to be, to deal with this issue that is of, extraordinary proportions for the natural systems of the world, but also for all the world's people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Francis Beinecke, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Let's go on the phones first to John in Irving. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm a member of the NRDC, and I thank you for your work. I would like your response to an assertion. I do not see much hope for the non-human world, that is, climate, environment, animal populations, without our stopping human population growth. What's your reaction to that assertion? Thanks.
Well, I think obviously the pressure of humanity on the world does have a big impact on the natural systems. And, I think more and more support to help nations with growing populations to provide, economic development opportunities, educational opportunities, those things that really pull people out of poverty and put them on a sound economic path, that's shown increasingly to be the fastest and quickest way to slow population growth. So the more we can invest in education and economic opportunity, the more chance we have to really slow that growth and ensure that we ensure the long-term protection of natural systems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Have you come to an understanding, given your work, of why there are still a sizable number of people who are able to hold the belief that either this isn't really happening or that it's not likely to cause the kind of suffering that so many scientists have predicted?
Well, I think it's a good question, Chris, because it actually mystifies me when you look at the amount of information out there that there is still that divided opinion. And the interesting thing is that that's fairly emblematic in the United States, but isn't true in other countries that are, have the same information and experiencing the same debate. So I only, I have to kind of attribute that to the fact that climate change has become something of a political football with a lot of voices raised back and forth, or it is, isn't it, or isn't it, or, what's the truth here? So I'd like to, look for ways to get, and this is actually the reason that I wrote the book, was to provide people who are kind of on the fence questioning, wondering what is the real story here, a fairly simple, short explanation of what's the science, why is this a problem, what are the impacts, and I think this is really important, what you could do about it, because even if you don't accept the science of climate change, there is a very major reason from a security standpoint in the United States to invest in a clean energy future, and also in a health standpoint, because the power plants, the automobiles that are a major contributor to carbon emissions are also affecting the health through other kinds of emissions of Americans every day in their home and in their, in their transport to their jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So there are multiple reasons to take this very seriously, and I think if we could get out of the kind of political football nature of it and really focus on why investing in a clean energy economy makes sense for the United States over time, and, by the way, addresses the issue of climate change, it would be a much better discussion to have.
What kinds of sticks and carrots make the most sense in terms of ensuring domestic compliance with whatever standard the United States commits to?
Well, I think that one of the things that the legislation in Congress is really focused on is how you unleash American innovation. And the way that the legislation is being designed is to put a cap on carbon, essentially to put a price on carbon so that companies will look at the least cost way to provide the services they're providing. So if you're in the electricity sector and suddenly you generate electricity from coal and there's a price on carbon, that's going to increase your coal costs, your coal operations. But if you can invest in efficiency, that will basically reduce the cost to the consumer, to your to your stakeholder. So by putting a price on carbon, what we hope will happen is really unleash the most cost-effective ways to prepare and produce that kind of energy, both for electricity and for transportation, that will be available to the American public at least cost.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Farmers Branch and speak with Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Enjoy your show. Just one comment on what my observation on some of the resistance to the idea of the climate change, that at least in people that I've talked to, seems to be a perception that isn't so much based on the science, but it's based on a belief that a treaty or the solution, a global solution, will provide a license or a means for countries to basically try to transfer the wealth of our nation or other nations that are wealthy nations to the poor nations, whether the science justifies it or not. And that's a concern that it's really an economic issue, that it's a wealth transfer issue more as much as a science issue.
Well, that's interesting, Paul. I think that what we're really trying to do is design legislation that will unleash American innovation and unleash economic opportunity here in the United States and create a lot of jobs. There was a recent study by the University of California that, identified as many as 2 million jobs could be created from clean energy investments. So I think there is a very, and I can tell you that every member of Congress is very focused on ensuring that Americans, first benefit and second, aren't negatively affected by what's putting in place here. On the other hand, it is a global issue, and the Copenhagen Conference starting next week will definitely show that, there are 190 nations who are affected here, and the less developed nations of the world who may feel the impacts first, like sea level rise, do feel that there is a responsibility on the part of the developed world to help them create their own clean energy economies and avoid some of the impacts that are on the horizon. So I don't think there will be a wealth transfer, but I think there will be a global system. But I can assure you from many meetings that I've had in Congress that the members there are first and foremost focused, as they should be, because these are the people they represent, on ensuring that Americans are not negatively affected economically as a result of it, and that there are mechanisms in the legislation to modulate that impact.
Do you have information on what kinds of incentives tend to give the most bang for the buck in terms of government investment?
Well, I think that the thing that, as I mentioned earlier, that we really think is the best investment and gets the quickest bang for the buck is in energy efficiency, because these are technologies that are available now. They're very hands-on, so they put a lot of people to work. If you weatherize 10,000 homes, there are people in those homes doing that weatherization, putting in the insulation, putting in new windows, upgrading the heating and air conditioning systems, so that unleashing that opportunity here to really address two parts of an issue. One is tremendous unemployment, and two is our rising carbon emissions, is the quickest way to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul. Hi, Paul. Are you with us?
Yes, I am, and I wanted to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment on the transportation aspects and mention that the United States is way behind many of the other developed countries in developing high-speed rail. It's very fuel efficient, and I'm hopeful that the private sector will get involved with the development of high-speed rail, and that's what my partners and I are attempting to do right now.
Well, let me comment for a second on high-speed rail. I agree with you. It's really, whether you go to Europe or Asia, you're stunned by the success that they've had moving people very, very, very rapidly on high-speed rail, and we're way behind on that. The stimulus package that was passed earlier in the year had a major investment in high-speed rail, and I think the initial location of the investment is in California from, from Los Angeles to San Francisco. So I'm hopeful that this is an issue that or an area where that the United States will begin to take very, very seriously, because the more we could get people out of airplanes for short-term distances, we've saved carbon emissions that way, and then the more we could get people out of their automobiles and move on mass transit, such as high-speed rail, we could reduce carbon emissions that way too. So it's a win-win, but it does take a major commitment on the part of the government to actually, you know, get the right-of-ways done and make the investment to unleash that opportunity.
Frances Beinecke is here. She is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, Frances Beinecke. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Vaughn in Dallas who asks about your reference earlier to a billion people on the planet being in the path of rising ocean levels. He asks, what options do they have to move inland or elsewhere, and how much time would they have to adjust?
Well, I think that's really the issue, is how many options do they have? And I think that's why we're so intent on getting clean energy climate legislation and getting a world agreement that can really avert the most serious consequences of climate change before they happen. You know, you look at a country like Bangladesh, where, you know, so many people there live at sea level and at risk on an annual basis from terrible storms that come in, flooding that comes in the other direction. And, you know, there really aren't any places for people to go to. And some of the island states, like the Maldives, this is a nation that will disappear if sea level rise is allowed to go to what the projections are without taking action on climate change. So, you know, I think that one of the things that really propels certainly me and my colleagues at NRDC, but, you know, others around the world who were working on this issue and world leaders, is that there aren't a lot of alternatives, which is why averting the worst consequences is the most important thing we're working on right now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Dwayne in Dallas. Hello, Dwayne.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question for your guest. We're talking about reducing carbon emissions by clean coal and getting households to use more economic methods, which is still costing a lot of money. The Atomic Energy Commission did a study and found that if we built about another 450 nuclear reactors across the country, we could reduce our dependence upon coal and most fossil fuels, petroleum and that, almost 100%. Now, I know that we had the problems debated about the transfer of spent rods and things like that in the storage, but all of that has been proven to be safe and economical. Why can't we go that route?
Well, that's a good question because the answer really is the economics don't work for nuclear energy on a large scale. If you look at the United States, we have, I think, 104 nuclear power plants, none of which have been built in the last 30 years. I think our last nuclear reactor was built more than 30 years ago. So, you know, why hasn't that happened? Well, one of the primary reasons is that nuclear energy has not competed in the marketplace with other sources of electricity like coal or natural gas or efficiency. So, you know, what we're looking for here are low-carbon alternatives that are economically viable. And I think if we get this legislation passed, we'll see whether nuclear does compete with these other sources. There are issues about nuclear energy that do need to be dealt with. One is how waste is handled, and we don't now have a long-term solution for waste. The fuel rods, spent fuel rods, reside next to the power plants, and they have for the last 30 years, and nobody thinks that's a long-term solution. There are also security issues as well as non-proliferation issues with the weapons-grade material that could, you know, be used for other purposes. So, you know, there are issues about nuclear power, but the thing that has really kept it off the table for the last 30 years is the economic costs. Those continue to be true. In fact, I recently saw a study, an update of a study by MIT, where they updated their own study. And just in the last 5 years since their original study, the cost of nuclear energy continued to go up. So their early estimates of what role nuclear could play were actually deflated because of these cost increases. So, you know, in my estimation, if you could deal with the issues of waste and proliferation and security, nuclear could compete to some degree, but I don't think it would ever be 100% of our energy supply. Right now, it's 20% of our electricity supply. You know, I think it'll probably stay around that level, maybe 20 to 25%. It will never, I think, compete economically enough to replace the 50% that's now generated by coal.
Francis, can you give us a brief rundown of some of the things that we understand today headed into Copenhagen that we didn't have access to before the beginning of the Kyoto talks?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's happened really around the world, and we'd like to unleash it here, is the promise of renewable energy. I think renewables, both solar and wind, particularly wind, but increasingly solar, are much more competitive in the marketplace, provide much more of a solution than, you know, people guessed, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. You just need to go to Europe, where in Denmark 20% of their electricity comes from wind, or to Germany, where they've made a huge commitment to solar. I don't know what percentage it supplies, but quite a bit. Or you even go to China, where clean energy technology, I was recently at a conference, a green tech conference in Shanghai, and they're going to unleash probably more solar and more wind than any other nation. So there's tremendous promise. We're still, you know, the amount of our electricity supply provided by renewables is still in the single digits, and it could definitely get up into the double-digit numbers. So, you know, that's a huge new opportunity. And, you know, also there is a long-term bet on really doing the technology development, research development, and deployment of cleaner technologies that would take the carbon emissions out of coal-fired power plants. And, you know, we really have to get working on that, unleash that opportunity, because we have abundant coal resources. China has abundant.
Francis, are you with us? Somehow we seem to be having a problem with that line. My guest this hour is Frances Beinecke. She is president of... there you are. Okay, you're back.
Sorry, I don't know what happened there.
That's okay.
But anyway, I mean, there's just a lot. I don't know where I got lost, but there's a tremendous amount of coal out there, and we've got to get cleaner coal technologies in the marketplace quickly.
Let's go next on the phone to Fort Worth, where we'll speak with Ken. Hey, Ken.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
Ma'am. And I'm enjoying all your shows.
Thank you.
The first question to your guest is, I've seen ads recently on television about encouraging energy efficiency. That's mm-hmm. fine, and that's good. But why don't they ever stress if you lower your usage, you'll lower your bill? They don't do that.
Well, that's probably because the advertisements are promoting some technology or another that they're selling to you. But there's tremendous data that shows what a huge savings could result by real, very significant investments in efficiency in the home. And the one state that's done that very, very successfully is the state of California, where they've kept their per capita energy use flat over the last 20 years, where the rest of the nations has increased significantly. And the way they've done that is they've gotten their utility companies to invest in efficiency on behalf of the consumer. So the consumer's costs have gone down, and I think that there are lots of ways to save energy in the home that we're just beginning to communicate effectively to the American public about. And I think if we have some sponsored programs through the utilities that can really unleash that potential, that would be a significant reduction in our emissions.
Have you seen a growth in willingness by Americans to sacrifice, to actually use certain appliances less, or to do away with conveniences that we've enjoyed all this time?
I think there is a segment of the American public that's very keen on that, that's really very focused on living a more sustainable lifestyle and figuring out what they could do to make their own lifestyle more sustainable. But I think the majority want to know what their better choices are. So, for example, last year, Walmart made a commitment to sell 100 million compact fluorescent light bulbs, which use a great deal less energy than incandescents. They actually sold 145 million. So to me, you know, that really shows that the American consumer, when given a choice, will make the right decision. And when you think about 145 million light bulbs, that turns out to be a lot of power. I would have to do the calculation to figure out how many power plants that is, but that is saving a tremendous amount of power. And the more we could get those kinds of products into the marketplace, tell people about them, make them cost competitive, and American consumers make those choices, that will decrease our emissions very, very rapidly. Same thing in cars. More fuel-efficient cars do the same thing.
Can you talk about some of the reasons you have to be optimistic about our future?
Well, I'm an environmentalist. You look at these issues every day, and you have to be an optimist to keep going. But the thing that actually keeps propelling me is the amount of enthusiasm that people have for solutions. You know, here at NRDC, we have people coming into our offices literally every day who have, you know, the new strategy, the new technology, the new invention that they've created that they want to unleash, take to the marketplace. They really think it's the answer. And I think it's that kind of enthusiasm for solving the problem. Recently, as I mentioned, I was up at MIT where I'm on an advisory board. And, you know, here's some of the brightest kids in America who can't wait to be the, you know, inventor who's going to figure out the answer to this. And there are literally thousands of them. So, you know, I'm optimistic because I think that the issue of a clean energy future has really penetrated, you know, across age groups, across sectors. And so there are people, you know, in our companies, in our universities, in our governments, who are really trying to find the answers. And if we have, you know, that amount of kind of creativity and brain power focused on it, I'm optimistic that we'll solve it.
It really is an interesting tightrope that you and others in your position have to walk, in that you want to encourage people to believe that a solution is possible, but you don't want them to think, well, I can sit back and wait for someone else to fix it.
No, I think that's a really good point, Chris, because the fact is we've had a lot of the solutions around for a long time. I mean, we've been here at NRDC talking about efficiency since 1980, almost 30 years. It hasn't been unleashed yet. And the reason is that we haven't had either the price signals or we haven't had the public policies that really create the rules for how to unleash a clean energy economy. So we think that the solutions are there, but you do need the price signals and you do need the policy direction so that you can make these long-term, consistent investments over time to reduce our carbon emissions and get us down a clean energy pathway. It will not happen by itself because business as usual is just too powerful.
With so many people interested in watching what takes place in Copenhagen, can you talk about the difference between the sticking points for the industrialized countries of the world and for the developing world, and how the issues in some cases are quite different?
Yeah, the issues are quite different. Of course, for the developed world, for countries like the United States, we're basically talking about transforming our entire energy sector, which is an enormous undertaking because we're a fully developed country with a very strong economy. So that is a big wrenching that requires real policy direction and incentives to help that transition. And for those, energy-intensive industries or, heavily dependent coal economies, there has to be assistance to help in that transition, and that's what our legislation here is designed to do. So ours is sort of going from business as usual to something quite different, and what does it take to do that? In the developing world, it's a very different feeling. There's a feeling of great vulnerability to the impacts of climate change and very little resources to deal with it. And there's a feeling of equity, that the issue of climate change was created by the last 150 years of the industrial age that they were not part of, and yet they are going to bear the brunt of a lot of the consequences. So there's a feeling that they need help, that, there's an equity responsibility of the developed nations of the world to assist them through technology transfer, through assistance in leapfrogging those dirty old approaches to newer, cleaner approaches, but also financial support and financial incentives to help them. Also in the developing world, there's where they have basically the lungs of the world's tropical forests, which are huge carbon sinks, but also can release a tremendous amount of carbon if the trees are cut down. They would like a system that incentivizes them through a monetary system to keep those trees growing. So the issues are quite different, and they will have to be worked out. And, of course, these things become even more complicated in a period of acute recession where, maybe 10 years ago, people said, well, the developed world should, provide funding for the developing world. There was a lot more funding sort of available because of the strength of the economy. Now it's a very different picture. So those financial conversations are much more strained.
Frances Beinecke is president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Her new book is called Clean Energy Common Sense, An American Call to Action on Global Climate Change. Frances, I really appreciate you spending the hour with us.
Chris, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.